Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode of the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. Beautiful day to be alive. We are stoked to be coming off of an episode with Mark Summers of Yes, Double Dare, What Would You Do, Unwrapped. Just a great episode. You should go check that out. But we also have a great episode for you today. We also have some amazing sponsors that I am so happy to work with weekly. One of them is a woman named Susan Robb out of Toronto, Canada. She's a woman who lives out her mission to inspire others. Susan's a client partner for the Center for Leadership Studies, original home of situational leadership. CLS is deployed in over 70% of top Fortune 500 companies. Susan's also a business, has a business as a speaker agent to many of the guests we've had on this show. Paul Templer, Coach Jim Johnson, Bob Rathbun, all these really fascinating people that could do professional development, inspirational speeches, seminars for different employees. So contact Susan Robb, R-O-B-B, on LinkedIn. Susan helps us out a lot here. Now, we are lucky to have three breweries help us out on this sponsoring this podcast. One of them happens to be one of my favorite places that I hope to be in a couple weeks, and that is the Adirondack Brewery, located in Lake George, New York. The Adirondack Brewery is looking for volunteers to help pour beer and serve food during the Lake George Village Oktoberfest on Columbus Day weekend. Perks include free beer and food, tickets to the Adirondack Brewery Oktoberfest, which is the week after, October 14th, a free t-shirt and more. To sign up for or for more information, contact Bonnie DeCook at BonnieJDeCook, D-E-C-O-O-K, at gmail.com. And new specials are now available at the Adirondack Brewery's pub, including a chicken caprese sandwich and the Barnyard Burger topped with pulled chicken and hickory smoked bacon. The one and only Adirondack Brewery. Now, Demented Brewery is located right over here in Middlesex, New Jersey. It's just a great place to get a beer, one of the best tap rooms I've ever seen. On Sundays, they are always releasing something new. In fact, this last Sunday, they released Double Dementia, their double IPA. This Sunday coming up, they're going to be releasing their Oktoberfest lager. Demented Brewing is just one of the coolest places to grow. Go grab a bite to eat, check out the murals, enjoy. Just a really up-and-coming brewery in New Jersey. That is Demented Brewing. Joe Fisher from Manskirt would like to tell you. Manskirt is located in Hackettstown, New Jersey, right there in the old bank building. Really cool, open vibe, good brewery, 8 rotating taps, seasonally inspired ales. They got Oktoberfest coming up this coming weekend. 3 days of fun and German beers. They have at least 3 different German beers on tap, maybe 4. October 10th, they're going to celebrate their 2-year anniversary with a party from 12 to 10 p.m. Manskirt Brewing, located in Hackettstown, New Jersey. Finally, Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. Trivia Revolution is one of the sponsors of this podcast. I host for them on Wednesday nights at Tap House 15, where I also run the Verbal Shenanigans comedy shows. Each week, you can come out, win prizes to different craft beer bars and breweries all over New Jersey. Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. All right. This week on the podcast, if you are a fan of metal or just intricate, like metal fusion, I don't even know what you call math metal, you may have heard of Dillinger Escape Plan. And if you've heard of Dillinger Escape Plan, you may have heard of their guitarist, Ben Weinman. Ben was recently listed as 100 greatest guitarists of all time by Spin Magazine, and just a really cool, open guy. So check out the podcast. Here's Ben Weinman. Enjoy the podcast.
This is Ben from the Dillinger Escape Plan, and you are listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Yeah, here it comes.
Here,
right at you.
I feel like
open your mouth.
Oh God, we're going to the places already. That
bend over and get shenanigans.
All right, you're getting gross now.
Oh,
you're getting gross.
No,
bend over and get shenanigans?
I got the t-shirts and everything. I got 100 in the car.
Yeah, well. I'm sure they're selling just like our t-shirts at the moment, as my foot is...
Scott, I'm thinking outside the box. Come on now.
As my foot is on the box of t-shirts.
$15,
people, if you want to... We'll start with an ad. You want to buy a t-shirt, $15.
I know we just started with 3 minutes of ads, but
yeah.
Still.
Yeah. But welcome back, everybody. It's good to be back. It's good to be back. Last week was a long night. If you tuned in last week, we had the one and only Mark Summers on, but it wasn't easy. Mark Summers from Double Dare, as you know, and What Would You Do, and Unwrapped, and all those shows. And last week we did two interviews. One of them will be on this show. I'll reveal it to you guys because we break down the third wall here at Verbal Show.
I thought it was the fourth wall.
Third, fourth. Couple walls, I don't know.
We just
break the whole room down. We have no walls, wall. So we
that sounds better. I'm going to put that in the next set of t-shirts.
We had two interview. It's better than I'm going to shenanigan you up the butt or whatever your motto was 2 seconds ago.
Well, it wasn't that, but now I got to think about that.
Yeah. So we had two interviews. We were supposed to start at 6:30 last week.
Mm-hmm. 6:30 and I think 7:30,
something like that.
Yeah.
And each interview just consecutively got moved back and moved back and back to like 8:30, 9:30, which is fine, whatever. But so one got later and the next one got later. And we eventually were here to like basically midnight just interviewing people.
I got home at 11:30 that night.
We had to get Mark Summers on, and we went through the nightmare of going through a conference call. We kept calling and it would just play like sweet porn music for a while. Yeah. And
nobody was number. Like,
you're the only one in the conference.
Hey, we're on the conference call. I think Mark has to join as the leader.
But overall, the interview was great. If you did not hear that episode.
And you probably didn't.
You should probably go back and check that out. What do you mean? We probably didn't. We've had good numbers the last couple months. Our numbers have been consistent.
Chiming up.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we talked about it before. Like, we had that one, like, 6 month period where the numbers made zero sense. Mm-hmm. Like, we had normal numbers, which what we would expect. It was growing, like, you know, 10, 15, 20 listens here and there, 30, you know. And then, like, one random month, like, you started tweeting, and our numbers would just go to, like, 5,000, like, just a bazillion, like, listens per month, and it was a little weird. Never really matched what I thought we were actually doing.
Yeah, we never really kept that audience.
No, and I don't think those were listens. I really think at the time they were, like, clickbait, yeah, anything that was clicked or whatever, but who knows? But we're doing good. We are happy to be back. I am extremely happy. I'm extremely happy.
Scott, why are you extremely happy?
I'm very happy because I got probably one of the most awkward events I ever had to do in my life out of the way.
You went to your prom?
I finally went to the prom, and...
Good for you.
You know?
Were the parents looking at you weird?
They didn't care how old I was this time.
Yeah, I was about to say, when you gave that 14-year-old corsage...
I shaved, you know, I fit right in. But no, I this weekend I went to a wedding.
Ooh.
Oh yeah.
Congratulations.
Mm-hmm.
Where's Alex's ring? I didn't see it.
No.
Walking in.
So I went to a wedding. My best friend, growing up. So we've been friends. One of my best friends. I got a couple best friends. I don't really know that whole best friend. Like, who's your best friend? But one of my best friends got married to my ex-wife's sister.
Yes, I do know of the story.
Yes. You're the co-host. You're supposed to elaborate for the audience and ask questions.
What? How could
this is not
happen?
The conversation we have on the deck, and you go, no. What? On the deck, it's different. Okay, but anyway. So, yes. My ex-wife... her sister and my friend met at my house at a party once.
Okay.
Years and years and years ago. And
the old podcast home.
Yeah. And they were on and off, on and off, on and off. And then eventually they like got together and moved in, and I knew they were getting married. Now, it's just fine.
Mm-hmm.
a little awkward. You don't control who anybody, who someone loves, you know? Like, you don't,
yeah,
you don't control that. But it was probably the awkward, most awkward for me, because obviously I know that side of the family, and I know my buddy's family. We grew up, you know, since 14 years old. I was always at his house. Mm-hmm. We played soccer together. So essentially, out of all the guests in the wedding, I probably knew the highest percentage of people.
It was the most familiar you could ever be, but still in the weirdest spot possible.
In the weirdest spot possible. Now, though, no shock. Like, I don't talk about it much on the podcast, but me and my ex are not on good terms.
Hearing stories from you on the deck, I would agree with that.
Yes. Not on good terms. Basically got screwed over pretty hard. We won't get into that. Okay. Mm-hmm. But not on good terms. So it's not even like this, like, oh, hey, how you doing kind of thing. It's like, I wanted nothing to do with her. I don't want to look at her. Don't want to talk to her. Don't want to do nothing. So that's essentially the game plan I went in with. You know, I'll shake hands and smile and do the whole grit my teeth and bear it. And
now, were you both in the wedding party?
Yes.
Hmm. That makes it even harder. Yeah. Now, was there like was there get-togethers before this event?
There was a get-together that I did not attend. Okay. I had something else going on, and to be honest with you, I wasn't going to attend anyway.
So I hear you.
I'd rather just, like, podcast or pet the dog or do anything other than that. Now, my buddy understands. I give him credit. He understands the awkwardness of it. If I can go back in time, I probably would have asked to not be in the wedding, but I would have attended the wedding. That would have been a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. But I made the mistake of saying yes, you know, kind of like heat of the moment kind of thing. Like, yeah, sure, you know. And I even told him at one point, I feel a little awkward about it. Let me think about it. And I decided, okay, let's go through it. And it's been not a super fun conversation between me and Alex, me and the girlfriend. And, mm-hmm. You know, because it's awkward for both of us. I'm torn.
Now,
I'm in the middle of an awful, like, no matter what, it sucks for me, right? It sucks because I understand why she would not want me to go or not want me to be involved. I have my reasons why I would obviously want to go for my friend and be part of his thing. And, you know, I was the best man. He is also divorced, but I was the best man in his other wedding and stuff like that. So we're pretty close. We've been close forever. When he was overseas and stuff like that, you know, I sent them packages. Like, we're close.
Was the lady more going into it angry at her, jealous? What's the kind of pushback into it?
I mean, we've had a lot of conversations, but I think some of it was, you know, I think she had some similar feelings too, like my mother did. My mother, like, fear that I was going to go, like, something was going to happen.
Something's going to kill.
Anything's going to happen. No. Like, something, like, yeah, some argument's going to come out of nowhere, and something's going to rage.
Yeah, nothing in a good way, just like, yeah, I'm in the back of a squad car.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's definitely part of it. And, like, oh, if you see her, you're going to talk to her. Like, a natural fear that somebody who you know, would never really, you know, it's a weird situation. You're not really ever put in most lifetimes.
Yeah.
You know, never mind. For all parties involved. Mm. So I decided to go, and if not, we decided that it would be better off together to not go, for her to not go. And we went back and forth forever, like, oh, I will go, maybe I'll go to this, and then not this, and then I should be. I mean, my thought eventually was, because she said to me, I'm not going to go. I thought about it. And it made more sense because I'd be doing, like, the groomsman thing, like the pictures and all the stupid stuff that goes on with that. And she would know no one. So that's so now I'd be worrying about myself and the awkwardness and then her awkwardness. And then it just makes an awkward bonfire. You know, like, there's too much going on.
That sounds like a great band name. Yep. Awkward Bonfire.
Awkward Bonfire, yeah. We can make that happen. You could play the triangle. I think we've also said enough. I've definitely said a million times, that's a great band name in this podcast. Mm-hmm. If I ever have the chance to listen to 167 episodes, we'll, like, make a list of all the awkward band names that came out of it. But
Scott, after all this, we named it the Ghost Cast? What the hell?
So
Doug Max and the Miracles?
Long story short, I went. Everything was fine. 'Cause the first day was fine. It was a rehearsal dinner. I sat in one corner. She arrived late, of course. Mm-hmm. Into another corner. It was fine. We just ate, and I left. And, you know, there was no communication at all.
Well, just out of curiosity, when you're at the rehearsal, she walks in. What's the initial thought? Is it anger?
Nope.
Is it...
Nope. I have my... Listen, I was never worried about me losing it or me being out of control or anything of those matters. I was... The only worry I ever had was, like, her being weird and crazy, because we all know that that definitely...
Yeah.
Definitely happened many a time, and hence the reason... Mm-hmm. We are no longer together, thank God. And
there was quite a few awkward moments for me in living room where I'm just looking around like, I know something's happening.
No, I want to.
Scott
wants to kill himself.
Flat out say ask this.
Yeah. There's nothing worse than that, right?
Yeah.
It's almost worse being part of someone's awkward argument or something like that.
Yeah.
But no, there's no. It sounds weird, but I actually want her to show up to the rehearsal because she was late. Like, I felt bad for my buddy and his wife-to-be. Like mm-hmm. she was a big part of the wedding. Like, where the fuck is she?
You were kind of into it, like, typical you.
Yep.
Why aren't you here for this person? Yep.
And I didn't care. I was just, yeah. You know. And it was nice to see, like, certain people, like, from even my buddy's family and, you know, family. Like, they'd say hi and, like, hey, what's up? Everything was very civil. And so the rehearsal dinner night goes by, no problem. Wedding comes up. The day, no problem, because it was all hanging with the groomsmen. So, I mean, I could hang out with guys are easy. Mm-hmm. You know, guys are no problem. We're hanging, having a couple beers, probably starting around 11 o'clock. we had these nice koozies that my buddy Brian gave me, and whatever. So, the wedding happens. We do the picture thing. No problem. All the way through the night, and I had planned with Alex, like, when to pick me up, because I Ubered there. And because I was no way in hell I was staying at the hotel or partaking in any kind of like after parties or anything like that.
Yeah.
I was going. I was business, like straight business. And you know what? Like in the end, it was fine. I behaved myself, all that. And I had to leave early. I didn't have to. I was just done. I was tapped out
mm-hmm.
of seeing everyone saying hi, blah, 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 blah. Oh, it's great to see you. How you doing? How many times can you answer, like, how you doing? What are you up to? How you, you know, I was live, blah, 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 mm-hmm. blah. It's like, how many times can I say, doing fine, you know, working hard, busy, you know, blah, 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 blah. That all that small talk after a while is just like, okay, I want to go be with my friends. I want to go be with my girlfriend. Like, I want to go, like, talk and relax or not say anything at all.
That's one of the most awkward moments in weddings. Like, you get the uncle that you haven't seen in like 4.5 years, 6 years, and they want to chat away like they're your best buddy, and you're just like, I'm really not sure what your first name is. Can I just go?
Yeah. So everything went well until the last 3 minutes of the wedding.
Bum, bum, bum.
Nothing crazy, but like I'm saying bye to everyone. I said bye to like, all people knew, like, hey, I'm getting out of here. Good night. It was nice seeing you again. Blah, 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 blah. And she gives me, like, this little look, like, oh, like, where you're going down the hallway. See, but, like, she had something to say.
Mm-hmm.
And the years of angst and the years of me being screwed over came out for about 2 minutes straight on her. I have nothing to say to you. Beep, beep, boop, boop. Like, nothing to say to you. You've had years to get me the money that's owed to me. Like, you could have brought it, you could have made an effort, blah, 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 blah. I may or may not have dropped a C-bomb once or twice.
Ooh.
And luckily, my buddy Brian's friend that I we get along very well, was just like, come here, buddy, let's get a drink. Like, and just like kind of like pulled away.
Yeah.
And that was the end. And Alex picked me up and I went outside. And I gave it like this mega like exasperated kiss, like this is done with, it's over with. And this was like a good like cathartic, like, it's done with, because my mom was worried, Alex was worried, I was not looking for, I was dreading it for weeks. And we went out for like a drink or two, and it's over. So the event is over
until the sequel.
No sequels. Know nothing.
What do you mean
done.
There's a funeral?
And the best part of it all is that she's like 900 pounds now. But I am what? Yeah.
And she's short. Yeah. It's one thing to be 6 foot and fat. You can kind of disperse it and look all right. You short, you dead. You going to.
Yep. So, all in all, Scott's here. Scott's good. Scott is, he's in good spirits. Feels like a huge gorilla is off the back, or whatever they call it.
Good for you, man.
So, it's good, man. I guess I'll, well, yeah, I guess I'll tell you real quick. So, the next day, I never felt drunk at any point of the wedding, but we started at 11 and and probably ended at 11.
The slow progression.
The slow, like you had too many beers. Day drinking. Yeah. And the next morning, I went to Joe Fernandez, good friend of ours in the podcast.
Former guest.
Supported. Yeah. His wife was diagnosed with multiple myeloma a long time ago, and she's in remission, thank God. But they were doing a race, and I told Joe months and months ago, I'm going to do the race. I'm going to get myself on. And it was like a little goal setting thing for me. I'm like, I'm going to do it. I've been running a lot lately.
Mm-hmm.
And, so me and Alex go to do it, and I wake up like, no, like the alarm, like, no. And
this
like,
can't be.
I basically had just drank Yingling all day. and like, I was like, no, it can't be. And, like, I actually woke up before her and, like, we gotta go. Like, we just made it on time. And so I'm, like, on the way down, I'm, like, laying back in her seat, like, covering my eyes. And I'm like, oh, God, this is gonna be the war. I'm gonna die. Like, even like a paramedic, like, when we were driving past, I'm like, stay on call, guys. Like, please.
It'd be great if that person who hands out cups of water, you grab it, vomit in it, and hand it back.
Or they hand me a shot of vodka, like, keep it going, drunk.
Hair the dog.
So we gather, and it was cool. And they hit the start button. I didn't even know like we were starting. Oh, crap.
A start button?
Like the,
they don't have a pistol?
No pistol. It was like a thing, and I'm running.
That sounds like a noise I do.
I didn't even like stretch or anything. I'm just like running and like.
I was still in the back seat of the car. I'm like, what the hell woke me up?
So like me and Alex try to stay together. She's like, I'll run with you. I'm like, no, you won't. And she's ahead of me within 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I go at my pace and I'm fine. I'm not trying to set records. My goal was just to finish, like, and not stop, and you know, do it for a good cause. And
now, are you keeping a jogging pace? Is there any walking involved?
Jogging pace. I get to about a mile and a half in. And definitely the amount of alcohol I had the night before started taking over. I started cramping on the bottom of my feet. But this has happened before. So I have to stop for about 3 minutes to like shake my foot out and kind of get the cramp out.
Mm-hmm.
But I finished the rest of the race.
Know that feeling?
Running. Yeah, you know. Yeah, when you're walking carrying a heavy microphone.
Or having sex with Izzy. As one of the answers at my
Go back to that episode. Find all about that. But then I had a banana before, and I'm like, this will sop it up. I had like 9 waters before. I'm like, I got to flush this out.
Uh-huh.
Like, I have a banana. No, I'm jogging along, and I'm just farting. Like, like every 2 steps, like toot 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 toot.
Man, everybody's passing me for some reason.
Either wow, I'm really in the lead, or why is everybody running past me? And then I have a banana beforehand, and I'm running, and I'm just like, bleh! Like just shot half a banana out on the side, and but you know what? I finished the race, 35 minutes and something seconds.
All right, respectable.
So, well, I figured that 3 minutes of walking, it would have been probably 33-something, which is what I think would have been fast for me. And I was running. Alex got like a 31, and she's a runner. So I figure I'm only like 5 minutes behind her, 4 minutes behind her. Next year I do. We raised some money for myeloma and went out for a good cause. Cool. But it was hard, man. I was sweating straight Yingling out of my body.
Mm-mm-mm.
But let's get to our guest.
Let's do it.
Yeah, it's about time. Berlow, I know you like hard rock, but I don't know if you're a big metal guy.
I would say I st- stay closer to the rock, but I have much respect for the metal groups.
Yeah, yeah. I dabble metal. I like metal.
Yeah, you stick your little toe into the heavy metal?
I stick my toe into the metal ocean.
It's cold, but I'm going in.
In the metal ocean every once in a while. But one of the bands that, when I was growing up, they seemed to hit really big when I was like in my high school days. They're known for very, very, very technical music. Very math core. They almost invented like a genre on their own. It's very, very math oriented. The drummer's playing in these crazy timings that are not easy to replicate. And so we have the guitarist from Dillinger Escape Plan coming on the show. Now Ben Weinman, I got in touch with him through Tom from Tap House 15, and
shout out to them.
I mean, here's a guy who's listed on the top 100 guitar players of all time, according to Spin Magazine. Very well known for his guitar style. So I'm very excited to get Ben Weinman on the podcast.
Here. Oh, man. Can't wait.
But let's get him on and give him a call.
Boop, 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 boop.
Hello.
Ben Weinman, welcome to the Verbal Shenanigans podcast.
Are we live?
We are live and ready to record.
What kind of, okay. So we're recording, then we're not live, right?
Well, yeah. Live to us means that the recording is hitting record.
Okay. Gotcha.
We're called the Confused Podcast. Yeah,
we don't have to be live if you need something.
No, it's all good.
Ben, first off, thanks for giving us a few minutes on the show, man. I appreciate it.
No problem. Sorry, it took so long for us to figure this out.
Oh, no problem. Actually, right before you, we were interviewing Mark Summers from Double Dare. You remember him?
Oh, I know Mark Summers. Yeah, I remember him.
Yeah.
Still Mark Summers.
Yeah, yeah. So it's wow. A very interesting night. We're interviewing a host from an 80s, 90s game show on Nickelodeon. And
I'm sitting here next to my wife, and I think she may have said she was on it. She sort of whispered to me that she was on Double Dare.
Hold on.
No, don't let her whisper. Get this full story.
Yeah.
She was on Double Dare with her dad.
This is the most... this
surreal.
Has come full circle.
Yeah.
So she was on Double Dare.
I never knew this. Yeah, I never knew this.
See, Verbal Shenanigans opens pathways in marriages.
Man, this is just...
Wait, you gotta ask her, did she win?
Did you win?
No.
She didn't win.
Did she do that thing where she had to go in the mouth
and
find the flag?
She didn't win something. Very nice.
Ben, thank you so much. Tom put me in touch with you, which I guess you guys go way back.
We go way back. We used to call him Shug White.
What?
That's the best nickname. Tom goes. Me and Tom are pretty close now. I do the comedy at his place and trivia and whatnot.
Yeah,
but
great.
So how did? Let's tell me a little dirt on Tom before. How did he go from like now? Well, it's how do you go backwards? How you went from this craft beer bar that's beautiful and has amazing food?
Mm-hmm.
I guess he was managing a. Progressive metal band for a couple of years too.
Yeah, I mean, like he was pretty much responsible for joining myself and our drummer, the other like original founding member of the band. And his dad owned a steakhouse, which was located in the spot where his place is now. And
the New Orleans
Steakhouse. So he grew up in that restaurant business, but. You know, I think he was a little more attracted to the excitement of rock and roll and punk rock for a little bit until he decided he wanted to actually pay a bill. and then he realized the restaurant business ain't so bad. But
No, especially his place. It's awesome.
Yeah, man. I mean, what happened was, is how I met Tom was many years ago, there used to be this store in Montclair called Let It Rock, and it was like this punk rock vinyl store that we would all just like drive there just to pick up like vinyl, like a rare hardcore and punk band.
Right.
And I went there, and there was a flyer on the wall that said like looking for guitar players for hardcore band, and said a bunch of influences bands I was into, and. So, you know, where I came from, there wasn't a lot of seeing things happening.
Well, you're from Morris Plains, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm doing this out of Denville right now. So
okay. Yeah.
So I used to work out of Morristown.
Yeah. So know the area completely.
The like, you know, the underground music scene was limited. It was probably a lot more college rock happening and stuff like that around here with all the universities and stuff. But yeah, no, we would go to Philly, we'd go to New Brunswick, we'd go to New York or whatever. So I had no idea where this phone call, where this phone number would lead me. And so when I called it, Tom answers, and it was literally 10 minutes from my house, which was surprising. And he was just kind of like, yeah, my boy Chris is a great drummer. Come over and, you know.
It's interesting that he even back then, he's like the mom boss just sticking it together.
He was.
It's amazing.
Yeah, he was. I mean, I could talk about him. He used to be the guy in school that would bully the bullies. Yeah, like he'd put like a football like quarterback in a garbage can, you know? And just like
He bullies me now. Mm. He bullies me now.
Yeah. So anyway, so that's how I met Tom. He was the guy who didn't play an instrument that was always, you know, trying to make stuff happen.
No. So. I wanted to ask you, you formed this band in 97 now, so really we're at the 20-year anniversary of Dillinger.
Wow.
Which is pretty remarkable. I remember hearing your CDs in early high school, kind of like being like, what is this? Like I was playing in bands, playing bass and stuff like that.
Gotcha.
And I wanted to ask you, so you come out with this, whatever you want to call it. There's, you know, people hate labels like math rock, prog metal, you know, where it's just, did you guys set out to that? Like, were you like a metalhead going into it? Or did you just like, you wanted to make loud, aggressive, like thinking music, like, because your music is very different than just, hey, we're a heavy band. Like,
right.
There are songs that I could still listen to and analyze the timing of them and the structure and the math part of it. Where did that come from? Was it from the original two of you, or did that come over time jamming? Like, how'd that work?
Well, when you're that age, you cycle through influences and like so quickly, you know.
Right.
Thinking back, it's like, man, in a matter of like 5 years, I went from being like into like hair metal to like finding my way down a rabbit hole to like heavy metal,
mm-hmm.
to like super super death metal, to then being like pretty, you know, in hindsight, fairly quickly within like 3 years, being like, wow, this all kind of sounds the same,
right?
And like fast double bass, which was the most impressive thing in the world when I was like 16.
And that,
well, it's impressive, but it's like, you know, it's an athletic thing at this point. It wasn't really, you know, just technical ability, like physically technical ability kind of wasn't doing it enough for me. So I then started kind of simultaneously getting into fusion and jazzy stuff. Right. And punk rock and hardcore at the same time, which were really opposites. Like the punk rock scene was like, you didn't even need to be able to play your instrument to be in a band at all. You'd just be like, all right, you play bass, you play guitar, three chords, let's do it, you know?
Yep.
Whereas like the fusion stuff was highly technical and advanced in a way of just like, you know, well, there was the virtuosity, but there was also like a large amount of influences and cultures being, you know, dissected within all that music and stuff. So I guess, you know, within a 5 or 6 year period, I went from just like being fascinated with anything with a guitar to really like getting into really deep underground eclectic stuff. And but the punk and hardcore scene attracted me because the normal person could find shows.
Yep.
They could play shows. You didn't have to, you know, get signed to a record label or like, you know, be discovered by some guy to go find play a show somewhere. You could play in a basement or a VFW hall or just all clubs around the area. So I liked the DIY thing a lot. I really liked the just making things happen without waiting for someone to do them for you. So I guess it was really an amalgamation of all those things. mixed together that made the Dillinger sound. And at that point, I had already been through a few bands. The other guys in Dillinger had been through a few bands. We really didn't think, we weren't really accepted by any kind of scene, or none of our bands really did well. Nobody cared about them when we were trying to be more genre specific in what we were doing. And right. then we gave up. We were like, let's just go and go to college and start our careers and do this for fun. And the second we decided to stop trying to make music that we thought people would want to hear is when it ironically started to work out. So was it intentional to make some kind of a genre, or like to start some kind of we had no idea it could go even half as far as it did, and we had already given up on trying to make that happen. So I learned a lot just by that happening in itself about like the right way to do things, and the fact that you have to do things for the right reason if you want them to translate to people, and if you want to actually change things or make a difference or impact anyone's lives, like you really have to believe in what you're doing and care about it.
No, when you and Chris was the original drummer of the whole, right?
Yeah.
Now, when you and Chris started, did you set out to do, like I'm always fascinated by the, you know, like the math timing or the, like, mm-hmm. did you set out to do that, or did that just happen organically, like, okay, I have this beat, and was it more he wanted to do these math beats, or did you want to do these guitar parts, or was it a blend? I mean, I'm sure it was a blend.
I think
in some
it was
aspect.
A blend because we both had a few different influences, but then we had a few that were the same. So there was a couple bands that we really liked and that influenced that kind of thing. There was a band called Cynic that was a band on Roadrunner that was really diverse within the catalog of typical, like, really death metal that was on Roadrunner at the time. So that label had things like Deicide and Sepultura and Obituary, but then there was this band Cynic who the drummer ended up being like, at one point he was like playing reggae on a cruise and then became like the drummer and then became
so awesome.
And then started playing death metal, you know, so he obviously was very diverse in his playing, and the guitar players were like just jazz guys who liked death metal. And there was all kinds of crazy, interesting things. The bass player played like Chapman Stick on some of the songs, which
Love
was like
it.
A really crazy, you know, instrument. So we were highly influenced by that. And although it didn't sound like Dillinger exactly in any way, shape, or form, because it was way more tame, like there was a lot of, they were pushing themselves in different directions within their genre. And then on top of that, I was into a lot of punk rock and like indie rock and like math rock. There was bands like Dazzling Killmen that a lot of people don't even know in this day and age, or like there was just a lot of there was kind of like this movement of like noisy math rock. So it wasn't metal and it wasn't really necessarily technical, but there was a lot of time changes happening, and it was really wild and off the cuff. And like just always like almost coming off the rails, you know, just like crazy. So there was that influence going into it. And then we were into bands like fusion bands like Mahavishnu Orchestra and some of the bands from the 70s that were pushing things with different time signatures and things like that. And then that band Meshuggah came along and was doing like obviously really interesting things.
100%.
You know, within metal. And so there was a lot going on that, you know, I can't say it was any one thing, but
yeah, I guess I didn't really mean
together the two of us just started pushing each other a lot.
Right. And, yeah. I guess I didn't mean any like one person in particular, but was there someone that was like really like I want to do like the math rock thing, like, or just kind of built?
I think we were both into technical stuff, but I was more into like the energy stuff.
Right.
And he was more technical and I was more into like the noise and the energy and the spazness, like. So I think he pushed me to be more, to like grow as a musician a little more. And I pushed him to stop worrying about being a musician a little more. So, you know, when he started, he was very like technical and tappy, and he had like seven splash cymbals. Like,
like
a rack with like cymbals all over it and all these different little drums and tiny toms. And I was like, that's lame, man. Let's fucking like just get a one kick drum. You know what I mean? Let's get one
like
kick drum.
Carter Buford from Dave Matthews Band.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I'm like, look, and then, you know, so he would be pushing me to just like be better at my instrument, and I'd be pushing him to stop worrying about his instrument. Like, let's break some shit, you know? And I think it was the combination that made it what it was.
That's
like
awesome.
Both of us really were important in that way.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of interesting how you're into so many different brands of music and you went to school of psychology. Do you kind of see a similarity where it's psychology, you're trying to like look into different points of view, and with music, you're looking at the different ways to go, yeah, like this part and that part, and kind of make it your own kind of mesh?
Well, I mean, you know, psychology is, I don't know. The thing I guess I relate the most to, like, my studies in school were just the interpersonal relationships. Like, you always learned about these studies in class, about these studies where people would take on roles, and where there was just all, you know, almost every single thing we learned about in every class, every case study or different school of psychology, you could apply to like the situation of being in a band and living on the road and dealing with interpersonal relationships and ego and like all these things are just like to such an extreme when you're in this environment. It's almost so extreme that you can't even see it. I don't think you take the best psychologist in the world to be able to
analyze bands,
musicians, really. Yeah, but
no,
I don't think it affected like the music, you know, really particularly, other than like I'd be sick of being in class and just want to go take it.
Now, let me ask you, when did you realize that this is going to go from renting studio time and jamming, or jamming in the garage, whatever, to holy crap, we got something here? And did you guys record first? Or did you tour first? And then when did you realize, okay, we got something, and then like you actually started like making a living and exploring the country, and then you guys have been all over the world eventually. But
yeah.
When did that become a reality?
Well, I will say there's not one, and I say this to people all the time in bands and stuff, like there isn't one decision that will make you or break you.
Right.
You know, like you can learn from everything you do, but it's like your career that matters. So it's very hard to think of like, well, there was this one tour that really took us to success, or there was this one thing. I mean,
of course,
or if we had only done this thing, we would have been much bigger, or like, you know, so, but I will say that, we were kind of like just started writing songs together. We were all in different bands. And I was in a band, Chris was in a band, we joined together and took like the most serious guys from each band and just joined a new band, and that was Dillinger. And then we started just writing. We didn't have any like a name for the band, we didn't have shows, we didn't have a label, we had no intentions of necessarily recording. We just wanted to make songs and have fun.
Mm-hmm.
So we started writing songs, and a friend of ours who just had decided he wanted to start a record label, and he was doing shows, like local shows all the time. He'd rent out these VFW halls in like Red Bank, New Jersey and stuff. And he wanted us to play his show, and he wanted to release our music. And we just were kind of like, whatever, you know, we don't need to.
Right.
We really just gave up. Like you can't make it. You can't make it a music. Like it's a waste. And so he's like, we're like, we'd like to play the show. Yeah, we'll play the show. And at that point, we just wanted a form of expression and a way to like vent off the week. And he asked us what our name was, and we're like, we don't have a name. He kind of forced us into getting a name because he wanted to make a flyer.
That bastard.
So like on the spot, we literally just like, we were watching a documentary on Dillinger, and they were talking about his escape plans, and like somebody in the room was just like, Dillinger escape plan. We're like, done.
Wow.
Like we never thought about it. We never cared. We had no real care about it. And at that time, it was a really long, obnoxious name. Every band just had a one name. It was like Korn, you know, or like just these bands just had one word names, and we had the Dillinger Escape Plan. Like nobody could remember it. It's hard to say. Everyone's like, that's the worst name ever. It takes up. It's so big that it ends up being the smallest font on a flyer. You know, like, but we didn't even care. So that was that. And then we played a show, and that show, every show we played, like, would turn on into another show, because it'd always be some kid or some promoter that would see us and be like, whoa, that was, I guess what it was is that we had stopped trying to be successful. So we stopped worrying about all the semantics. We finally stopped worrying about what slot we played on the bill, or,
right.
You know, or we just, oh, we're going on first. Cool. And we'd play in front of three people, and we just didn't. And then those three people would walk out of the room and be like, fuck, you know, like that band was like real. That was some real shit, you know? And so they would talk, and that would lead to another show, and there'd be six people in the room next time. And then somebody there would be like, I do shows in Philly. You got to come do a show in Philly. And be like, all right. And then before we knew it, we were, you know, kind of like cool shit in the scene. We were like, cool. You know, and we're like, how the fuck did he become cool? You know, we were the band that like would give someone a demo and we'd turn around and they throw in the garbage, like, and laugh. Yeah, like,
yeah.
How did we become cool all of a sudden? We were, and these kids who had labels who wouldn't give us the time of day were calling us up trying to put out our albums and trying to release our music. And we just, we were kind of like, I think we were pretty bitter too, because we kind of like, we're like, fuck everybody. Now you like us? Now?
Yeah.
Now you want to give us the time of day? So we, that kind of contributed to our live show and our music as well, because we're really just bitter and we hated everyone. We felt like we didn't fit in anywhere. We felt like we tried to get into underground music to escape like the bullies and the jocks and the people in school, and then the scene was no better.
Right.
So we really were just like an island. We just didn't give a shit about anything else that was going on. We didn't care about other bands, what kind of music they were playing, what was popular. We didn't care about trends. We just kept doing our thing, and it was like slowly, like one after another. It just kept building and building to the point where we had to make a decision. Do we quit our jobs and do this, or do we not take these opportunities? And that's really what happened. We, at a certain point, there were so many opportunities to tour and see the world and go places that we just had to quit our jobs and go for it. And so that was probably in around 1999. So like it was pretty quick. I mean, in that time it seemed like a long time, like 2 years of playing heavily in every shithole that we could find, but like doing it while working. And you know, and then at some point I think we got like a Mr. Bungle tour, and then we got offered to play in Japan, and we're like,
kind
of gotta do this stuff, you know. We can't we can't say no because we got to go to some shitty job. So, but there was many years of us really eating shit. Like we really, you know, were in tough, you know, conditions for a very long time. And at one point, we just started to, by being super frugal and, you know, doing everything really very DIY, we ended up starting to get bigger while still maintaining a low level of expenses. We really didn't have middlemen. We really were very on top of every single thing we did. And so we did everything. Like I made the websites. I made, we did our own layouts. We did, we did everything, you know. We booked our own shows. We created our own light shows, you know. We built our own light shows at a Home Depot stuff, like. And as we got bigger and other bands were spending money, we just kind of kept doing the same thing and eventually started to generate income, like real income. So that's kind of, I guess.
I mean, it makes complete sense.
The long and short answer.
I mean, with the grind and making your own ways, I guess that kind of helped out. It allows you to be more vocal. I mean, I've read up how you discuss different philosophies and public and publicated into the Huffington Press. I mean, is it almost kind of a pushback to you when you see a band maybe not getting through that struggle, that maybe get a little more pushed up in other concerts or in popular music?
Yeah, I mean, we saw it the whole time. And when we started, the new metal scene had become really big. So right. We were seeing bands that wouldn't otherwise be considered kind of metal or whatever, selling millions of records and creating pretty formulaic music.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd see these Warped Tour type bands on the scene just get really big really quick because they had the right haircut or the right tattoos or the right, you know, and the truth is we saw all that stuff over 20 years. I've seen so many trends come and go.
Right.
And, you know, many of these bands became much bigger than we ever were and or ever could be. But very few of them lasted the test of time.
Yeah, I think that's also a testament to, like, your music, isn't for the average Joe. If I played it for my girlfriend right now, she'd probably, you know, punch me in the stomach. But when you get into it and you analyze it and you've seen it live and you realize the talent behind it, and that's what stands the test of time. And you guys pushing yourself to do different things and different albums, that's why you've been around for 20 years.
I think it does. I think you're right. It takes work to like our band.
Yes.
It's not easy.
Hmm.
And so while that's held us back, it's also made very, very loyal fans, because
100%.
When it does click for someone, they feel like they're really part of something special, because they do get something that not everybody understands. So they are part of a very special kind of group of select people who have done the work and taken the time.
Well, it's like really the enlightened ones. They understand, you know, like, I get it now. You know what I mean? Like, they get what you're going for and what you're doing and, you know, kind of the character of the band after a while.
Yeah, and I think they really believe that we believe what we do. They believe, they trust us. You know, they trust that we're honest and we're telling the truth. And once people trust you and they understand what you're doing and they believe it, that it's real, then they'll follow you, you know, they follow you into the fire. And that's a real privilege we've had for our fans, to allow us to evolve and grow and try things and take risks. And cause I think that they know that we're doing it for the right reasons.
And it allows you to do more stuff with different bands. I mean, you're doing so with System of the Down. I think Serge is one of the best, you know, front men there is out there. No, I'd love the stuff he does with the orchestra. He's always going out trying different stuff.
Yeah,
it's amazing. Yeah,
he's great, man, and I really respect him. And he's always trying to push himself into new directions and new territories. And you know, the easy thing for him would just to continue touring the world with System of a Down. He's like one of the biggest bands in the world. But he really takes time to do his own thing and grow, and I always respected that.
No, Ben, this band now has been through God knows how many, different rotations of dudes and all in and out. And you're the last guy, last original last member.
Idiot.
Now let me, is that like a? I think, is that like a bittersweet kind of thing to you, or is it like, do you almost feel now like you are the elder statesman who has to continue this band going forward? Obviously, you still love it, but do you feel like you got to continue going forward, and you're the guy who's got the original the original DNA code in you from the band?
Right.
You're the guy who can say that's not Dillinger or that is Dillinger. You know what I mean? Like, Do you feel that responsibility going forward?
Look, one thing I was thinking about the other day, with these last shows already announced and seeing the end in the distant future, I realized that, and I still am friends with almost every single person who's been in this band or worked with this band, and the truth is, and some of them were in the band in the early years and feel really sentimental about these ending shows, but they also didn't really get to enjoy a lot of the fruits of our labor. Like later on, when we were playing bigger venues and, like, you know, really making a living making this music, which is an amazing privilege, you know, and a luxury, really. So, trying to explain to everybody involved as we announced these last shows that everybody was an important part of this band.
Right.
I started to realize that it really is not one person. It's not me. It's everything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this band is not about a person or an incarnation of the band. It's just, this band is a fucking, like, it's mythology.
Right.
Mm. You know, it's like this band, and I don't know like how much you guys know about the band or whatever. I mean, you know, some people are mega fans and they know everything. Some people know a few songs on Spotify, but the truth is, this band has an insane history, and the whole band is an insane story. We've had members in car accidents, paralyzed, and
right.
we had a bass player that had a bullet in his head, and like it was completely crazy. And then, you know, we've had these singer changes that, like, you know, this guy come in from nowhere and like just join the band, and then like Patton was in the band at one point,
right.
and then. Like, we've gone through bus crashes, and we've gone through getting attacked by gypsies, and we've gotten, like, stories of people getting hurt at shows and us getting, like, insane injuries and, like, carrying on through all these hard times. And it's like the Dillinger Escape Plan. It's a bigger thing than any person, you know.
It's like the Hobbit trilogy, man.
It's really a combination of all these crazy things happening. Like, we should never be here. I mean, we just sold 10,000 tickets to our last shows.
It's crazy.
That should never supposed to happen. That was never. We were making music that was the antithesis of Markle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the Nookie was coming out, we were putting out songs that sounded like
the Nookie,
like you know. Like, awful to people. You know, we were making music that to the average person sounded like complete noise. And so it's kind of, like I said, this band is mythology. It's a story. It's not about any person. So if anything, I guess, you know, I'm proud that I was able to start this band, and really I made the decision to end it. And that feels empowering. It does, but...
I mean, you see the band... December 29th, 2017, last show, right? Terminal 5?
Yeah.
Is that like, I mean, obviously it's got to be bittersweet, but is it also like a breath of air that you're going out on your own terms too?
It really is. Yeah. It really is, because we did just put out an album that's gotten amazing reviews. It sold well. We put it out on our own label, and we're really proud of it. We're really happy with it. Our shows are bigger than ever. Our everything's at a height right now.
Right.
And I think to go out like that is just so satisfying. And I see bands all the time. And as long as we've been around, we've known a lot of bands and seen a lot of bands kind of come and go. And to know that we're not going to be one of these bands that just drift away into breaking up because we just don't get along anymore. The shows are not fun, or there's nobody showing up, or we're not writing music anyone cares about anymore. And to just be like, well, we just got to do this because we're at this age, we just have nothing else. We can't do anything else, you know, which is maybe the case for some of us, who knows. But the truth is that being able to say that we intentionally said this thing is done. We've said what we need to say, and we're proud of it. And it needs to just live on its own as this thing that existed, not this band that just keeps going on that you don't really know about anymore. Maybe putting out music, maybe isn't. Just
right.
You know, like, I just never wanted to be that. So it is empowering to be able to say that we did it on our terms like that.
Now, you've been listening so many top hundreds and whatever as being one of the best guitars, but you're also one of the more intense ones where you've told stories about breaking your wrists, bones in your neck while playing. Just out of curiosity, when those things occur, like, how long are you off stage when you suddenly realize something went wrong in your body?
Well, it is tough because adrenaline is a really powerful thing, and that's what I learned in this band. It playing in this band also just changed me as a person. When I was younger, I was really small and got picked on a lot and beat up a lot, and I was never in sports. My parents were in education. They were very, very cautious people, and this band. I mean, I was definitely always like, I always skateboarded and I always pushed myself physically to some degree, but doing this out of passion and realizing that the point of this band is to be at 1,000% all the time. Once that philosophy came into place fairly early in this band, and realizing that you're not made of glass, like, you know, if you have the will and you have the means, like, to go on, you will, you know? And so, yeah, there's certainly things that have happened to me and guys in the band that should stop any normal human being from functioning or from going on or even from ever working again, you know? But it's an amazing testament to the human body when you can do things like break bones and do all these things and continue to play because you feel such a duty to the band and to what you're doing to give it your all. And that's another thing that it's hard to compare that to anything else. Like, and I hate to compare it, but it's something that you feel like maybe only people at war can understand or something, or like where you have to just rise to the occasion, you know, and
How do you feel when you get like accolades like that from magazines and stuff like that, and being on a, like in all the influences in the world and musicians you've gone through, like anybody who's been influenced by, to be put on, to even be like in the same breath as like certain people, like whatever it is, but be put on a list, like you are 68-1, and I've seen a couple different things, but to be recognized, that's got to be an amazing accomplishment for you, even just to be recognized like that, you know?
Yeah, it's weird because I don't think of myself as like a great guitar player. Right. I think of myself as a guy who's good at making Dillinger, you know, like that's my thing. I am. And I think of myself as a guy who really is good at finding good musicians too, because I play with some of the most amazing drummers in the world.
And, yep, you sure have.
But,
yep.
You know, at the end of the day, it's a Wikipedia.
I know.
You know, it's a Wikipedia thing. You know, it's like, oh, it's on your Wikipedia. You know what it is? I really don't take that stuff that seriously because I know that there's a lot. I know that's so subjective. You know, like if the guy making the list happens to like our band, that doesn't mean I'm necessarily a great guitar player or as important as any of those people. But it's nice to know that we've made enough of an impact to even like be on the radar. And ultimately all it does is make people in my neighborhood who like Google me think I'm a real person, think I'm not a complete like worthless scumbag who they should be, you know.
You don't have a parking spot at your high school named after you?
Well, like, you know, no, but it's like it's funny to say that, but like I do live in, you know, Mars Plains, yep. A small town, and like I haven't moved my whole life, and I think maybe it's just because on the Mars Plains Wikipedia, I'm one of the top three most famous people ever to be here.
Who's being?
And I know that I think I'm the top. I think it's like
yes,
me and a
yes.
Like a watercolor painter or some sort. Like, but if I go anywhere else, even like one town over, I'm nothing. You know, like,
I can't wait till some like pop star comes out of there that's ahead of you, and all of a sudden you have a new band like right away.
Oh man, yeah,
compete. Speaking of like anything new or what's going on with you, I don't want to take up all your time, but what's going on in the future or the present? Like obviously the shows, the end of it, but
yeah.
What are the future projects for you? We're not sure
yet.
I
don't know, man. You know, like whether or not I'll play in bands again or not, I don't really have a plan for that. I'm not like a guy who needs to be in a band.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, like if I'm not doing something I'm passionate about and I believe in, then it's not for me. I don't need to be on stage being applauded or,
right.
You know, I don't need to make music that people hear even or, So I don't know. I'll certainly continue to make music because I have to. It's in me. But whether or not it'll be in the form of like a public thing, you know, band or anything like that, I don't know. At this point, I don't have plans to do that. But I'm doing like behind the scenes stuff. I'm doing management. I've got my label that I want to continue to nurture. And I'm just continuing to try to like, you know, make my living being somewhat creative or at least supporting creative things.
Now, as you're winding down now, when we ask a lot of groups to come on here, I mean, us being rock fans, what do you see the state of rock right now? Is we're finding it harder and harder to find new bands and can't get on the radio and stuff like that. What do you see the current state of rock and what can be done?
Man, it's weird because we're at a time where, like, you know, I feel like there will never be, like, really, really good rock bands that are as massive as bands used to be. There'll never be a Guns N' Roses or there'll never be another Metallica, you know. There'll never be, you know, there'll be, like, Justin Bieber's and stuff that are massive, massive major label, you know, things that have been made to be these massive pop culture phenomena, but there'll never be a fucking Billy Joel. Like, if there is, no one's going to know about it. There's never going to be a top 40 song or a top 10 song that's like 7 minutes long, like a Billy Joel song or like any of those classic rock songs that were like
no Bohemian Rhapsody's coming up.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was a massive hit, and it was like so original and like
good,
amazing, you know. And so, like so it's very sad to know that like that kind of music, you know, with the Bohemian Rhapsody, you look at like the amount of writers on that song and it's like two, you know what I mean? It's like lyrics to Freddie Mercury. Done. Yeah.
I mean, I just read his
Beyonce song and it's like four lyrics repeated for a minute for about 3 minutes. And you look at the amount of writers and it's like 14. You know what I mean?
I know.
So, and it's literally like a beat, you know, and not, don't get me wrong. I love me some Beyonce, but you know, it sucks that there's really isn't room for anything else, but that kind of like mindless.
Yeah. Stuff. I mean, maybe on the pop airways, but I mean, there's still some good stuff out there. And I think
but it's never going to be, never going to be a massive influence on pop culture.
Right. Yeah. I get it. Well, I mean, we'll see. We'll see. And, Ben, I knew I liked you when I was doing a little bit of research when I read how influenced you were by Flea, who was pretty much like the biggest influence in my music playing.
Cool, yeah, he's awesome.
Yeah, but you know, it's really cool to have someone who's so well respected, like as a guitarist. We also had Victor Wooten on a couple months ago.
And, oh wow!
Yeah, he was such an awesome dude, man. You guys should team up, man. You guys, I think you'd make some dope ass music.
He's amazing. He's an animal.
He makes me want to take my bass and just light it in a garbage fire. But
I pretty much take everything I do and light it on fire. Anything.
But Ben, thank you so much for joining us. If people want to go say hi or check you out or get in touch with you or see what you're doing, where should they go?
Well, I guess they can come see us play and like say, yo, Ben, what's up? You know?
All right, I'm going to go to the next concert, jump on stage because he said we could.
Yeah, come on up, man. But, you know, after December 29th, you know, I may disappear forever. So.
Do you have like a Twitter or social media that anybody could say with them?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, typically, you know, people can reach out to me on Facebook and I try to get back to people if I can. You know, obviously, you know, I mean, look, I can't talk to everyone, so basically fuck off. I don't want to talk to you. So.
There you go.
Go. Fuck off to the rest of you except for verbal shenanigans.
Do something great. Do something amazing.
No, we didn't.
And I
want
to talk
yet.
To you. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I'll be a fan of you. I'll ask you for an autograph. You know, that's the best way.
That's awesome.
Like, I'm still a fan of amazing, amazing accomplishments and art. And I go check out bands and I check out art and I go to see all kinds of things. So, you know, I'm still going out and looking for stuff all the time. So
that's awesome. Like,
my best advice for everyone else is to just make some amazing stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm. Ben, I hope to one day grab a pint with you someday at Tap House.
All right. Well, I'll see you there and I'll see you at comedy night.
Okay. You know what time it is, Berlo.
I'd like to phone a friend.
You don't have them.
Oh. I'm going to say C.
Can I phone my mom? She loves me.
Mom, pick up.
Please.
Come on, Mom.
It'd be great if he just keeps going for voicemail. But we got a second guest here on the show. Second guest on the show.
Woo!
Who we got?
We got Steve Pierce, part of Team American Chunkers. They are one of the...
They're a bunch of fat guys, right?
No. They are Punkin' Chunkers. Award-winning people team of Punkin' Chunkers.
The award-winning people team?
Yeah. Way better than that robot team.
I like English. Yeah, I went to...
I use it once in a while.
In a while. I went to... We went to two things. Once we went to... I think at Pocono Raceway last year.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was last year. If not two, I think it was
last year.
And it was pretty impressive. They had some of them that were just launching these things. And his thing.
I think that's pretty much the goal of it.
Yeah, yeah. One would
be weird if somebody like walked it across the field. Look at me! I keep on winning.
But I remember just as one particular launcher like launched it over Pocono Raceway from the park. It was insane. And then we went to like Adirondack Brewery had something where it was like they called it like Punkin' Chunkin', but you went there and you just fired pumpkins at like Donald Trump's face and Hillary Clinton's face. It was kind of fun.
Yeah.
It was a beer event, but and I've seen a lot of this stuff on TV before, so it should be interesting.
Yeah.
And let's give Steve Pierce a call.
Cool.
It's a good name. Steve Pierce got like a superhero vibe to it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. All right.
I can get behind a person named Steve Pierce.
No comment.
Mm. I see what you did there.
Mm-hmm.
Hello.
Hey, is this Steve Pierce?
Yes, it is.
Hey, Steve, it's Scott Brennan and Mike Berlo from Verbal Shenanigans. How you doing?
All right, how are you?
We are living the dream, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
Living the dream one day at a time. But thanks for giving us a few minutes on the show here, man. I imagine this is in a Punkin' Chunkin' Punkin' Chunkers life. This has to be the busy season, I'd imagine.
It is. We're out in the field looking for the best pumpkin to shoot.
All right. Well, let's start there then. What is the best pumpkin? What's the ideal pumpkin to shoot?
Well, we have rules that say it needs to be between 8 and 10 inches in diameter and 8 and 10 pounds in weight. So we try for the heaviest, most round projectile we can find, basically, is what we look for.
Now, when you do the competitions, do you bring your own pumpkins or do they supply them to you when you have these major events?
BYOP.
In the past, we have... provided some pumpkins for people. However, anybody who's really in competition will bring their own. We'll have had somebody grow for them and had a group of people searching for the ultimate great pumpkin, so to speak.
Now, do you work with a specific farm when you do these, or you just keep on looking until you get the perfect one?
Actually, we have a nice symbiotic relationship with some growers. And we provide the seeds, they plant them, we can go pick what we want, and then they get to take the rest and sell it.
Oh, pretty good deal.
Now, how does one actually get into pumpkin? Now, I know the first time I remember seeing it was like, I don't know, I remember it being like the era of like Dirty Job, like when Dirty Job was really popular on TV on Discovery Channel. I remember like watching Discovery Channel a lot on then, and I remember they had like a pumpkin chunking thing like every October or whatever. But how did you get into this?
Well, that's funny. I had a friend whose brother is an engineer who was on the team. So he described it. I had never heard about it before. This was about 2010, I guess. And I went down with a friend to see what it was all about. And fell in love with it. Actually, I fell in love with the mechanicals more than the cannons, but that's beside the point. And yeah, it was just turned out to be a great atmosphere down there, and fell in love, and then asked to join and got on the American Chunker team.
About how many people are on that team?
Roughly 15 or 20.
Wow.
Now when you are. When you went to these events, were they already very popular, or did you kind of get in at the beginning of all this? Because I know I was telling Mike right before we got on with you that I went to like an event in Pocono Raceway last year, and they had some things out. It was pretty crowded and whatnot, and I see signs and advertisements and stuff like that now kind of all the time. But when you got in, was it popular yet, or...?
It was. Actually, like you said, Dirty Jobs, Discovery Channel, the Mythbusters really gave it a good
push. Right,
maybe
that's right. Yeah.
And they hosted it a couple, you know, Jamie and Adam hosted it a couple of times in a row, and then they sort of let it go to the three other folks.
Right. The other
Corey. Those guys. Mm-hmm. And so at that time, it was very popular. I know that Chunkin, it started down in Delaware about 25 years ago, and then just sort of grew into what it was, which turned out to be, you know, over 100 teams, roughly 20 or so air cannons, a whole bunch of trebuchets and catapults, and then human powered and youth categories and all that. So it had morphed into quite an event.
When you go into these competitions, are you going in there more as like a scientist? Or are you going in there as a competitor? Where do you kind of lean towards as a part of the team?
Well, I guess we're pretty competitive. You know, we want to win. Although it's pretty neat because it has to do with science and physics and math and all this malarkey. And we have engineers on the team, and we've got some really smart fellows on the team. And, overall, you learn a lot. And we go in working with our science, let's say, see what we think is going to work. And we're very competitive about it. We really work hard at it.
Now, let me ask you, like, what categories are there? Now, I know when I went to the event, there's the mechanical ones, like you said, the trebuchet, like, but it there's some of these things that I think you guys are also part of, like, that launch these things, like, at ungodly speeds and distances, and then there's ones that are launching them, you know, several hundred yards. Where do you guys fall into?
Well, we, as the American Chunker team, with our air cannon, have shot a record-breaking competition shot of 4,694 feet.
Jeez. That's it?
That's the longest shot. That's it. That's all.
Wow.
What, you got something can do better? Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
Yeah, so
we got a really big slingshot over here. We're going to try it out later tonight.
Yeah. It's our wacky morning zoo radio bit.
There you go.
So, but go ahead. Like, what category is that?
That's the adult air cannon category.
Oh, okay.
Right. Basically, there's air cannons, there's trebuchets,
right,
and catapults are different from each other, but mm-hmm. close in what they look like.
Right.
And then there's a whole bunch of human-powered ones, and some are even just for show. So, yeah, you get a number of categories. In each category, there are some very smart people and some very competitive people also. So you get quite a variety of what a machine looks like, even if it's in the same category. I mean, the air cannons are kind of the same, right? You got a big tube and a big capacity of air. You press the button, the air shoots the shoots the pumpkin, right? But these other ones, they're really, the mechanical ones can be all sorts of different shapes and sizes and configurations. So it's really, that's where the interest really, that's one of the best interests. I mean, yeah, we like to shoot the furthest, but those mechanical ones are really fascinating to see.
Now, have you guys ever, like, first off, if you could shoot something 4,000 feet, you must need a ridiculous amount of space to do this in. But have you guys ever, like, had fun and shot these pumpkins, like, through cars or through, like into things to see if you could, like, explode something with a pumpkin? Because that would be my first thought.
Yeah, well, you know, it's potato cannons writ large, right?
Right, exactly.
It's a lot of fun. Yeah, there are pumpkin festivals and different types of things like that, or tractor poles and things like that, that we'll go to and shoot up a trailer or shoot up a van. Or we've actually shot 55-gallon drones that we were able to knock down and stack back up again. So, yeah, that's always fun to do. You know, a pumpkin from our cannon can go right through a car, basically.
Wow. So you don't have, like, an ex or someone you don't like that you blew their car away with a pumpkin? Happy Halloween.
Guys, my ex-wife, her house is 4,000 feet away.
She'll never see it coming.
Right, exactly.
No, don't shoot the pumpkin. She'll know it's me.
Now, okay, so these events, obviously they're happening all over. Are you guys does this have a do you guys have a budget? Like, are you able to find sponsors or anything, or is this all just basically you guys all chipping in to do a hobby together?
a little bit of everything, let's say. Right. You know, our team, the owner owns the cannon.
Okay.
He may have a little bit more money than he needs.
Where does he store it, by the way?
We store it up in New Hampshire at a friend's lumber yard.
All right.
And that's where we do a lot of the work on it.
Right.
Yep. So, yeah, we're all volunteers. We're not making a paycheck.
Right.
And a lot of the events we'll give to charities. You know, there was a bunch of charities, Meals on Wheels, March of Dimes, scholarships for engineering, scholarships for agriculture, things like that. So it is boys with toys, and women with toys. But it's also, you know, we have a charitable end of it, too, so we can sort of justify our playing around with these things.
How often can you practice with these cannons? And if you get, like, shoot something off and, you know, it's not a distance we like, how much can you really adjust for, like, the next attempt to change up things?
Yeah, I'd say that the cannons all over the country that do this, they have to be able to find a spot that's, you know, 4,000 feet long or 5,000 feet long, you know, to practice. And we managed to get a turf farm set up once or twice and do some long shots that way. Otherwise, it's mass, it's velocity, it's a radar gun. You know, you can, like I said, these guys are smart fellas, so they can sort of figure out how far it's going to go by the speed of it and things like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, I noticed when I went to the event over in Pocono, and I've also seen that the trebuchet thing has seemed to kind of become like a very popular thing with, like, Boy Scouts and group, like a project that, like, kids, I guess, can work together on and whatnot. And I saw a lot of them built several different ways, but there's definitely, like, groups and, like, troop flags and stuff like that. You guys see a lot of that?
We do. In fact, the Extreme Shunkin has a youth category as well. And it is the trebuchets or catapults that are often made just because, you know, they're easier. And, you know, you need adult supervision if you're going to be using a pressure vessel and, you know, high-speed valves and all that stuff. You know, you really need an adult. So the trebuchets, adults can be a little bit more hands-off and let the kids do what they think might work, that kind of thing.
Now, you're saying you just volunteer for this. Out of curiosity, what do you do full-time, and how often do you have to take time off for these events?
Well, personally, I was a teacher for years. I just switched over to doing some, my brother's got a high-tech company, so I just started doing some sales for them. But overall, it's a few, you know, let's call it September and October. We do a lot of weekend stuff, so that's filled up. Hmm. And, you know, a few days here and a few days there. It's not outrageous, the amount of time spent, but it is a commitment. And you got to, you know, we tend to take it a little seriously with regard to just being a team and working toward something that you would never be able to do alone.
Right.
So that's the draw that keeps us going. So, yeah, it does take some time away from friends and family, but it's also... yeah, kind of a strange compulsion after a while.
Well, I wanted to ask you about family. Have you seen this starting to become a generational thing where, like, a passed down, like, where people are bringing their kids, bringing family along, and it'd be kind of come of a family tradition, too? I'm sure you got to see some of that.
Oh, yeah. You know, every time we went down to Delaware, you know, the kids are there in the pit. With the adults who, you know, who are shooting off these cannons and other machines, and they're right into it. And I know that there's been a couple of father-son teams as well, and a son just broke off from the father's team and made his own
rivalry.
Trebuchet and things like that. Yeah. So and there's a father-son team down there. It was once called Old Glory, and then he passed it down to his son. And now it's called Young Glory. So, yeah, there's a little bit of that going on.
All right. So what is the ultimate goal for you guys? Like, is there a certain distance goal? Is there...
We really do want to break a mile in competition. That'd be great.
Have you broken a mile not in competition?
There has been a cannon that went to Utah where it's a little higher up and a little drier.
Right.
And he managed to shoot... 5,000 or more than 5,000 feet.
Oh,
I forget the exact number, but yeah, when you get good conditions, it's really very helpful. But in competition, we're, you know, down in Delaware, we're only about 70 or 100 feet above sea level, so it's a lot harder to hit that ultimate mile, you know, down here where it's often cold and wet and more difficult.
Now, I see you're world champions in the WCPCA. How many teams are involved in this, and, like, how many events to determine a champion?
Well, the main event is always in November. It's always three shots, one Friday, one Saturday, one Sunday.
That's it.
The longest shot wins. Yep, yeah. The longest shot wins. And like I said, there are other small competitions. We have our Extreme Chunkin' going on at the New Hampshire Motor Speedway October 14th and 15th, mm-hmm. which will be a blatant plug that you can buy tickets if you go to extremechunkin.com.
All right.
And there's one in Colorado also. And we're sort of going to be competing with those guys, even though we're not in the same spot. We've got a challenge with them. I'm not sure how many cannons they have at that one. But they are smaller. These separate ones, the smaller things, are definitely smaller than the big chunk down in Delaware, that's for sure.
Now, if people wanted to say hey or check out your team or see the chunkers, the American chunkers are going to be, where can they go?
They can go to AmericanChunker.com and you'll see our website.
That's different than AmericanChunky.com, right?
No chunky.
Yeah. Don't go on that one. Especially don't get your credit card. I found that out the hard way.
Yes. They're still billing you.
Yeah.
But you still get those magazines.
Yeah, I know. I keep on sending them back, but, you know, they're like, come on back to us, you know. I guess one last question for you, Steve. If somebody wanted to get into this sport, what would be your best recommendation? Would it be to start your own team? Would it be to try to get in on another?
Just start throwing pumpkins in the backyard?
Yeah.
Well, I would say that one of the things that our captain did was he went down to a chunk and observed and looked at what he thought he might be able to do. And you just take a look at a bunch of things, see what machine you might want to build. You know, it is interesting and scientific, but it's not rocket science either. So somebody could really decide to make a trebuchet and do very well and, you know, compete. It's not too difficult. You know, a few right. YouTube videos and a sense of purpose, and they can do it for sure.
All right. Steve, I want to thank you so much for giving us a few minutes, and I wish you the best of luck with your busy season coming up, and go take that title down in Delaware.
Well, thank you kindly. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I think to keep it, they should like evolve to different holiday. Like Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. they should be launching turkeys and you
Christmas,
know,
you shoot out fat guys with beards.
I was going to say St. Patrick's Day midgets. Redheaded midgets. They fly.
Just don't point towards the sun.
Yeah. But yeah, so it's pretty cool. Like I feel like I could get into that with like if I had a kid or something, I feel like that'd be a great project to like try to learn together.
You know? Yeah, you can get a small air compressor and see what you can do with it.
Maybe we should have a boyfriend, girlfriend off where me and Alex make a trebuchet. And you and Izzy make a trebuchet.
Oh, Lord.
And see who can shoot it further. But somehow I think one of the dogs will die.
Yeah. Babe, don't put stickers on it. It's not going to go further with that.
Why is Izzy's shiny and glittery?
How did you bedazzle that? How much money did this cost me?
How did you bedazzle a metal cannon?
I don't know. I mean, the army was complaining as is, let alone when we gave it back.
Yeah, the problem if I did it with Alex, like every time we go to work on it, she'd be like.
Well, you just shoot the cannon and wake her up.
Wake her up with a. What?
Stop shooting off pumpkins.
She'd be like, our cannon's awesome. I'd be like, I did all the work. But let's take a quick break and we'll get out of here. All right. You know it's in. It's a typical episode of our show when we have someone from a heavy metal prong band and a pumpkin chunker.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I mean, it's one of those, well, how are they going to come? And we'll show you.
We'll figure it out.
It's easy. Copy, paste, done. They're so similar.
We have had so many guests this year. It's crazy. I was thinking about when we said at the beginning of the year, once we started getting on a roll, that we're going to do a whole year of episodes with guests. So we're getting close.
I don't think we had one episode this year.
I know we didn't. And then even the week that we skipped, we put up the I Did That, the other podcast, which I count as other people on the episode.
Mark Rick and Donna.
The point is that we're just trying to not have to deal with each other for 1 hour.
Yeah. Remember we used to do two a week, and we were just looking at each other like,
I do remember.
I bought a new sponge.
I do remember it being a whole lot more like, want a podcast tonight? We just have like stacks of, like, I would just have files upon files of like things. There were so many things that never even made it. Like, we have a couple interviews that didn't make it. Maybe one day we'll talk about like all the interviews that we didn't add and why.
And we should bring them on the show.
Redemption.
I like that.
You have this opportunity to be better and more interesting. What's funny is we should call them without them knowing. Like just call them like, hey, it's blah 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 from Vertical Shenanigans.
And then we'll have like a theme music ready and all.
You've got 5 minutes, like a timer, like to be interested, and then we hang up on them if they're not good.
Mm-hmm.
But
sadly, there were some shows that wound up. We should have came up with that idea beforehand.
Yeah,
5 minute timer.
Oh, well, how are we supposed to know? How are we supposed to know who's interesting and who's not?
They were all good people in the end.
But I feel like I feel like we would be remiss if we didn't talk about the whole kneeling thing that's going on right now. Obviously, like I don't have to give you a background, but. You see the football teams kneeling, and what started with the whole Colin Kaepernick thing is now exploded since our awesome president has incited even more attention to it. Like, he's got to know. even well, the people around, maybe he doesn't have to know. I don't know
I do think he knows. I've kind of had this conversation with Izzy.
Okay.
He's basically getting a couple things done. Number one, when he's at a rally, he's exciting his people. And the key thing for that is he knows 3.5 years from now, he's going to need every single one of those votes that he got. So he's going to keep them excited about him, regardless if he's doing anything for them and all. And I'm saying that statement not even as a political statement on him, just saying whether he gets what that specific area requested or he's not meeting the bills, as long as he keeps them excited, they're going to say, yeah, I like him. I'm going to vote for him.
I agree. I also think there's a lot of these things to distract people from something else he's doing.
Well, that's,
I swear to God, he does it.
Well, he's poking the bear. He's basically saying, I know all the fake news, as I call them, are covering this. They're going to put it out. The people are going to get excited. People are going to react to it. And I'm going to go back to my people and like, see what's going on? See what's going on? Stay with my team.
Yeah, that and like the things that are important, like the North Korea stuff and all this, like oh, I made a mistake. Let me like deter everyone's attention onto something that, listen, in the end, it's harmless. Like, I'll get into my opinions on this in a second, but in the end, it's a harmless thing that I couldn't even go on like Facebook the last 2 days. It's been like mind-numbingly,
Everybody,
do you guys care this much?
Yeah, it's
one way or the other. One way or the other, like seeing it through. All right, go ahead.
I'll tell you a funny story from my side, and also, Redskins were playing on Sunday night, and last year for my birthday, we went down to Washington D.C., called a Redskins game, and Izzy got me a jersey down there, Jameson Crowder. He was really huge for the Skins last year. He's been quiet this year, but I mean, he was my favorite wide receiver.
I feel like you guys, your name is now really limited because there's only a matter of time before they start kneeling for, we're not playing for this team. Like, we're not playing with a name like this. Mm-hmm. You guys are in the political climate we're now where everyone's offended by everything. I still don't know how you guys keep holding on to the Redskin name. I don't have a problem with it.
I don't have a problem with it. As I've always said, if it was really a problem, there wouldn't be one single Redskin game without a protest outside.
Nope.
And it's always just the key moments. Like, I'll guarantee this Monday night there's going to be a protest because both teams have a Native American name, Redskins versus Chiefs.
Yep.
They do that for special things. If Washington goes to the Super Bowl, I remember for four times in my lifetime they went to the Super Bowl. Protest then.
Yep.
But every other week and we're not going to get the coverage, it doesn't happen. And that's what hurts them. But in any case, so I have a Jameson Crowder jersey. And I told Izzy, you know, we can do whatever. The game's not till 8:30. And we watch the first, well, not the first game. That was London. But
Giants game?
Yeah, that was the Giants game.
And it's hockey season, baby. It's hockey season. Go Devils!
Yeah. But so she sees them taking the knee, and you know, she's a big processor and whatever, and she's super excited seeing it. She's like, yeah, I love it. She hates Trump, and she loves how they're protesting and throwing it back to him.
Yep.
And then that game's over. We caught a little bit of the 4:00, and again, she's like, yeah, they're kneeling. So we go to the game is at 8:30. The anthem's like 8:20 or whatever. Have to cover it.
Yep.
And all she kept on saying all day is, man, I hope Jameson Crowder takes a knee. I hope Jameson Crowder takes a knee. And I'm looking at her like, what does it matter either way?
If
Like they're doing the locking arms thing, right, or they're staying in the back, and they're not coming out until after the national anthem in the locker room.
Yep.
But game starts. Here's the national anthem. For starters, three quarters of the Raiders just sat down, which kind of surprised me. You know, but it's just going on. The song's going along. Then she sees like three Redskins kneeling down, and she's "Andy, Jameson Crowder, he's kneeling. I love him. He's my favorite player. I love him. She's going nuts. I'm like, he's not even that good this year, babe. I gotta be honest. I got his jersey. He's not that good.
Right.
He's a number three. wide receiver can't be number two.
Mm-hmm.
But she's just freaking out. Like, this is the best moment of life. The other thing, apparently, she was shocked that Kirk Cousins was a white guy.
Oh.
Like, literally, she they're showing the game. They show his
face. Were you just like, babe, he's a quarterback. Come on.
Well, they show her, and she's like, where's Kirk Cousins? I'm like, I pointed it out. It's that guy right there.
Yep.
I didn't think it was Kirk Cousins. What are you talking about? He's white. You're surprised that Kirk Cousins is white. What? No. Yeah.
She sounds like she's watching football for every other reason but the football game.
Pretty much. You know, she wore her Redskins shirt all day and on, then she fell asleep the second the game started.
See, like, I don't know. There's so many ways to go about this whole thing. But, like, one, I get the whole kneeling thing to me. I get, well, the blatant person who is the everyday, like, football, red-blooded American, like, standing for the national anthem, my parents died for this, my grandfather was in the war, or everything like that. I get it, like, up front and right up front, like, without delving into the issue, it's offensive. It goes, whoa, hey, that's the national anthem, man. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like a jab to the liver, like, you know, an unexpected punch. Like, whoa, hey, everybody's kneeling during my national anthem. This is my country, blah, 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 blah. And the other thing is they're hitting at football, which is like the old it's the Sunday football game. We get together. It's America's game, and we're gonna celebrate. And this is what Americans do. But on the counter side of that, it's people of color making their voice heard in a peaceful way.
Yeah.
When it comes down to it, you want to say, you know, they're not. Running cars into people and throwing riots and there's no looting or fires or destruction going on. It's guys who play a sport taking a knee for the 2.5 minutes with their teammates.
Yep.
With their teammates next to each other.
Not doing anything else. Not like screaming and all, oh, this sucks, yeah, or anything
not
like
putting
that.
Painting their face or saying like...
Not saying
like
a message.
Doing message. Yeah. Literally kneeling. To bring awareness to what started as police brutality. I don't think it's been. I think it's definitely the gap. The issue has gotten bigger now. Like where I don't think some of them are even realizing what they're kneeling for. But where Kaepernick started, it was for to bring awareness to police brutality. That was the thing.
Why now it went to politics.
Why? Yeah, now it's political. Now it's, I hate America. No, listen, do I think there's some sheep in the flock? Of course there are. The guy's just doing it. But, I mean, you see these interviews, guys are saying like, oh, we just want to bring awareness to the struggle that people of color are going through and, you know, racism that happens in the workplace and police protect. Why would any of that... As a white person or a white male or like any of that really bother you? Maybe because it's getting covered all the time. Like, is it really insulting you that much? Listen, this is one of the most peaceful protests you could possibly have.
Mm-hmm.
What was it, the Little Rock Nine? Was that what it was? Like the nine kids who weren't allowed to go to school and they kept showing up and had the government. They actually had the government of Arkansas like keep them out, and the national government had to stop it to let them in.
Yeah,
that is ballsy and crazy and meaningful. Like, this is as simple as it gets. This is the equivalent of wearing an armband or something like that, or a sneaker,
put a little patch,
or but you know the NFL, you can't do that. So this is the simplest thing they can do. They're not saying, oh, we hate white people and we hate America. They're not even saying anything, most of them. They're just kneeling and the game starts. That's it. And even people at work, like, I just bite my tongue. Like, oh, these animals, blah, 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 blah. Because maybe you don't like that
that someone who's not like you and your family and your friends that get together on Sundays is trying to say something or participating in something. But I think the point that has to be hammered across, it's nonviolent. It's nonviolent.
It's a perfect way to get the message done. I mean, number one, all the screaming about how dare they, what are they doing, blah, blah, blah. They're getting more attention, and you're giving them the attention.
Well, that's true.
So if you really don't care about, number one, get pissed off with, like, Fox, NBC, and all of them for showing the national anthem because they're just enticing you to look to see who's kneeling, number one.
Yeah.
Number two, I mean, it's pretty well documented. I think them coming out for the national anthem is only about 10 years old, and it was basically something pushed. I think the National Guard paid for something where the players had to come out during the national anthem.
Yeah, that's what I read, too.
So it's not like this has been going on since the 1700s and George Washington crossed the Delaware and he declared, we will all stand for the national anthem. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Simply put, they're just trying to make a statement, and they're doing it. Initially, it was for the cause of equal treatment for all races and all people. It kind of got pushed, whether you agree or not, with the president because of the president.
Yep.
And the best way to take it is either say, I love my country, I want to do it, or I understand what they're doing, I appreciate what they're doing, and I'll try to make a statement.
And then
just end that. And everybody who declares, I don't like it, ergo, this is what happens, ridiculous. If you're going to make a law that says we all have to stand for the national anthem, there's going to be a lot of arrests, and there's going to be a lot of riots, and
If you're looking at your football players as your voice of politics and policy, like, there's something wrong with you to begin with. Like, have your own opinion. Let them do what they want. Isn't that what all these people posting? My grandfather died. The people that fought is disrespect. Isn't that technically what they fought for? Like, isn't that what we preach? Like, they fought for your rights. Well, these people are activating their right to do this. So why do we have a problem with? Because you disagree with it? Because he disagrees with the white America, the majority? So what?
Yeah.
So what?
And then now people are jumping on bandwagons of other sports. Nobody's kneeled in hockey. Nobody's...
No, I'm going to become a hockey fan tomorrow.
Yeah, NASCAR. That was the biggest thing. Oh, the NASCAR owners say, if you kneel, we're going to fire you. And all these... And the president even tweeted, thank God for NASCAR. And somebody put that up on Facebook. I said, count the number of people in the car, on the crew, in the stands that are black.
Yep.
And compare it to one football game. And then the logic's going to sit in.
There's nobody
in there. There's one black driver currently in NASCAR. And he doesn't have a full-time ride. He might get one next year, Bubba Wallace, but...
It's just a lot of people are using these kind of things to hide their inner racism. And they use it to mask how they really feel. They have a problem with it because they're black. And that's what it is. Mm-hmm. It's the black man doing something that they don't agree with. And I don't know.
And then the sad thing is you turn around and say the Tiki Torch guys, well, they had a permit.
And it's just like, come on, guys. Come on.
And I don't want to be political. I can't deny I agree with some black people. There is a skew with the way they're treated with the police force.
100%.
I'm not saying every cop goes out there and is a racist.
Or every black guy is a saint. There's two ways to look at everything.
Yeah.
And that's where the smart people lie. It's the people that are so one way or the highway. Yeah. Like, I'm just done with it. I'm done.
Yeah.
I'm done with these memes of, these are all the black people that died for this country. This is who you're embarrassing. You're not embarrassing.
It's split between military people. I've heard some military people saying that's what I fought for. I've heard some say, hey, I wouldn't desecrate the flag. We're all people.
And then in the same breath, people will be like, well, they decry about when they're looting and getting angry and there's violence. And they're like, what happened to peaceful protests? You seen why can't they do? They're doing a peaceful protest, and it's still like, oh, my God, these horrible – like, protests are not supposed to be accepted by all. It's supposed to make you uncomfortable.
I think it's in the definition. I've never heard a protest with, you're all doing the same thing and I'm doing it too, but I'm doing this for this cause.
Like, do you think I like seeing players kneel during the national anthem and divisiveness over the... No, but it's... that's what are they supposed to do it when they're after the game when no one's watching? Like,
guys, I know it's 4:30 and traffic's pretty bad out there, but you know, I'm gonna take the knee.
We're only protesting during running plays. You know,
quarterback kneels out. Damn it! I wasn't supposed to do that.
Quarterbacks are all nervous at the end of games. Like, I'm not supporting it, but I'm trying to win. But I don't know, man. It's time for Americans to just lighten up, one, and two, like, if you're really not a racist, then, like, start accepting some other thing into the mainstream white world. I'm sorry. Start accepting something. Listen, can you be like, ah, oh, this stinks, they're kneeling during the anthem, like, my grand... I get the nationalism and the patriarchy and the patriotism, that's what I meant. But understand, it's not been perfect for all of us. Mm. You're expecting black people to stand for this flag and adore it when three generations ago their grandparents were slaves, or you know, three generations ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was like the 50s where interracial marriage was allowed or something like that. There are people living on the earth.
Yep.
That went through this stuff.
That weren't allowed to go to school with the white people. Like, give them time and, like let the – maybe learn something from them instead of, like, I don't know, shut down and be so ignorant. I can't take it anymore.
Well, at the very least, like I said, just say, I don't agree with it and leave it at that. Don't just The best thing I could say is all you people who say you're going to stop watching football, I better not hear posts next Sunday.
Yeah. No.
Do not come out there and say, I'm stop watching football. And they say, did you see this week?
When your fantasy team is 0-4, all of a sudden you're going to start watching. But I don't know, Burla. We'll talk about this more next week. Let's get out of here.
Oh, on a side note, I just saw the CNN alert. You know how Jerry Jones said, if anybody kneels on my team, I'm going to fire them?
No.
Apparently the whole team with him took a knee tonight.
With Jerry Jones?
That's what I got from the headline.
All right.
I still have to watch it, but...
We'll watch it, check it out, and talk about it next week.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. But anything to promote, Berlo?
Yeah, I'm going to promote a podcast that's going to promote ours. It's the Dirty Jerv Podcast. DirtyJerv. John, Clifford, and Preston, these are three guys who... look back at some nostalgic items and kind of talk about items. Their past episode, they talked about Matchbox 20, Flipper, Hulk Hogan, dating. They've done a whole episode watching Friday the 13th and commenting on it. So give them a shout-out as they're going to give us a shout-out.
Awesome. And I just want to promote a new show, a new Verbal Shenanigans show. We're trying it at a spot I used to host trivia at. Paragon Tap and Table in Clark.
Ah.
So it's going to be a similar kind of vibe, free show to the public, which is awesome. And I'm bringing out a lineup of myself, Mike Ciccoli, Jackie Byrne, and the one and only Mark Riccadonna.
Hell of a lineup.
So it's free. That's going to be on November 8th in Clark. November 8th. So there should be information up. So make your reservations today. And, you know, go check us out. But the best thing you can do, guys, is subscribe, share, and comment, because it makes us happy to be on this podcast.
Yeah.
And, you know, the best thing you can do is listen, obviously, but sharing it with someone, saying, hey, this is pretty funny. And also, go back and check out the past episodes. We've had so many awesome guests. It's hard to, like, say, listen to one or two, but even go back to just last week. Go listen to Mark Summers' interview. Mm-hmm. It was really awesome. I want to thank Ben Weinman for coming on the show, and Steve Pierce, and all that, guys. Life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back. Bye-bye, Berlo.
See you, Scott. I don't want to go, Scott. I'm taking a knee.
Thank God.
I'm staying right here till next week.
Hopefully you're protesting being on this podcast.
Well, I'll be outside picketing as you're recording.